From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm David Rennie, Washington bureau chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist. Joining me on the show this week are Linda Feldman, Washington bureau chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and Oren Dorel, foreign affairs reporter for USA Today. And here are the issues. In an extraordinary Senate testimony, the former head of the FBI called President Donald Trump a liar who tried to shut down a probe into links between Russia and one of his closest advisers. In Britain, the Conservative Prime Minister Theresa May scored an extraordinary own goal by calling an early election and then promptly losing her own parliamentary majority. London and Iran's capital Tehran were hit by terrorist attacks claimed by the Islamic State extremist group. And leading governments in the Arab world accused one of their number, Qatar, an energy-rich monarchy, of tacitly supporting terrorism, causing a huge split in the Gulf Arab world. So, once again, another extraordinary week of big news, but I guess here in Washington, people are pretty transfixed by this extraordinary kind of classic scene of a Senate hearing with everyone sort of stopping what they were doing and tuning in. Why was this Senate testimony involving James Comey, the former head of the FBI, so eagerly anticipated?
Why was everybody so anticipating this? For one, because we've had several, I guess, leaks of these memos and what James Comey was going to say, and people wanted to hear it from him directly.
So James Comey, the former head of the FBI, just to remind listeners, was fired by President Trump about a month ago. And so that was why he was in front of the Senate.
Right.
And teeing up his testimony, we discovered that he'd been writing notes to himself of conversations that he'd been having with President Trump. Why was he writing notes about conversations with the president? That's not something he would normally do. What was his explanation for that?
So what he said was that President Trump made him uncomfortable from the very first time that they met. And that feeling never went away and actually got worse. The first time they met, James Comey was at Trump Tower to brief the president on this dossier that had a lot of salacious information in it.
And this was a dossier alleging that somehow Donald Trump was being blackmailed or could be blackmailed by the Russians because of kind of lurid allegations of things that he had done on a visit to Russia.
Right. And he delivered that part of the dossier in private. It was decided ahead of time that he would deliver that to him in private. And Donald Trump asked him things like, you know, am I being investigated? And he said that the nature of the person, meaning the president, caused him to think that he should write down what they talked about before he forgot about it. And later, the president started basically wooing him to influence his work. There were several phone calls that were very unusual from the president to the director of the FBI, who's several steps below the president in the chain of command. And there were several meetings, including a one-on-one dinner that the president invited Comey to at the White House, that where Comey had to cancel a date with his own wife to go and have dinner, a private dinner with the president. And all these things and the
president. And what did the president ask him during dinner? Because that came up during the
hearing, he asked him for his loyalty. He asked him basically if he can count on his loyalty. And Director Comey said that he can count on his honesty. And they kind of went back and forth and stared at each other for a little bit. And then eventually Comey said, you can count on my loyal honesty.
Right? So, Linda, let's get to another one of the memos that came up a lot in the Senate hearing, Senate Intelligence Committee. This was a discussion of a meeting in the Oval Office where Donald Trump made everyone else, including his own chief of staff, leave the room. So he was on his own with then head of the FBI, that's top law enforcement official, and he wants to talk to him about Mike Flynn, who the day before Donald Trump had just fired as his national security advisor for lying about contacts with the Russian ambassador in Washington to, among others, the vice president. So you have Mike Flynn fired after only a few days as national security advisor, potentially facing criminal charges, certainly an investigation for allegedly misleading federal agents about his own contacts with Russia. And President Trump asks the head of the FBI to stay behind on his own in the Oval Office, and he makes a request.
He says to James Comey, he says, I hope you can, he says, Mike Flynn is a good guy. I hope you can let this go, basically.
Yeah.
He asks him to drop the investigation. of Mike Flynn. So this is a criminal investigation. And what James Comey has to say about that is, quote, if the president had his way, we would have dropped an open criminal investigation. So this sort of sets up the whole question of whether the president was obstructing justice, which is a crime. There's a legal question as to whether or not the president even can do that. Some people are asking whether, you know, they're saying that the president, Alan Dershowitz, is saying the president can order any investigation opened or closed. You know, he's a famous lawyer from Harvard. But that is part of what's being looked at right now. And James Comey talked about whether he was asked whether there's an obstruction of justice investigation. He said that there very likely probably is. I mean, all of this goes back to this whole Trump-Russia relationship. And he's basically said that all these things are being looked at. One of the things that really were interesting, I thought, in this whole hearing was that the president wanted to be told multiple times. He asked Comey three times on three different occasions whether he was under investigation. And Comey talks about how the decision to tell him that he was not investigated sort of transpired, and that there was a whole discussion among top FBI officials who basically, one of them apparently thought that the president should be told that he, you know, maybe that he was under investigation or could be under investigation, because they're looking at his whole organization and he was at the top of this campaign. Comey's decision was, technically we're not investigating him, but we're not going to go public about that, which the president wanted him to do, because that would require what they call a duty to correct, which would mean to correct the record and to change what they had said publicly, which means that everybody knew in the FBI that at some point they're likely to be looking at the president.
And let's take a step back from your Senate hearing and look at the bigger picture, the fact that the heads of the intelligence agencies in America, and certainly James Comey, say that it's absolutely clear that Russia tried to interfere in the 2016 mm-hmm. American election. And he said, what's more, that they had tried to get into, you know, hundreds, if not a thousand, government and non-government kind of mm-hmm. agencies and institutions. So a very severe attack mm-hmm. on American democracy by Russia with a view to meddling in American politics. Has that generated absolute unity in American public opinion? So from left to right, people are just as outraged. Or is this just another issue which is becoming a kind of partisan fight mm-hmm. between the left and the right?
It's just, unfortunately, just another issue that has become an object of polarization. I mean, you have Donald Trump, who accepted the reports eventually of Russian meddling in the election and then has actually backed away from that. And his supporters, his rock-solid support, which is most Republicans, not all, are really, they follow him on that. So I thought one of the more moving moments in the Comey testimony was when he sort of stood back and expressed his concern and pride, concern over the safety of this country from outside attacks, but also just pride in American democracy. We're the shining city on the hill. That's a Reagan-esque line from John Winthrop. So it's really very sad that Washington and the country has become so focused on the divisive presidency of Donald Trump that we're not focusing on the bigger picture of Russian attacks on this country.
And tell me about your feeling watching that testimony yesterday. I mean, the whole of Washington basically stopped everything they were doing mm-hmm. and was kind of, you know, watching their TVs or in the room. Were you cheered in any way by the quality of the questions that senators were asking? Did they do better than sometimes they might do? I mean, did you feel that the system worked a bit, or did you think that basically Comey didn't acquit himself well and the senators were sort of disgracefully partisan? What was your mood when you were watching that?
I was impressed by the largely bipartisan approach of the Senate Intelligence Committee. I think that's one of the few places in Washington that's actually working right now. You did have a few Republican senators kind of walking Comey through arguments that would hurt charges of obstruction of justice against the president. But in the main, I think, you know, they respected the fact that Comey is a respected man and that he was willing to testify under oath and appeared to be very honest.
And that was very striking, wasn't it? That you have the White House and some of the surrogates around President Trump essentially saying, you know, Comey is a leaker, he's a liar, you know, don't trust a word he says, except for when he says the president isn't being investigated, that bit you can trust. But It was striking that the Republican senators didn't really take that line, did they? They told Jim Comey, the former FBI boss, what a great man he was, what a patriot he was. There's a sense that these senators, they're not in love with Donald Trump. They're not in love with the task of defending Donald Trump. Is that fair?
I don't think anybody is envious of that task at this point. Part of what this hearing was about was the credibility of two men, which is Donald Trump and Comey. And Comey talked about that and said, he talked about his own record and that he's believable and that he's been consistent. And he talked about the president's record, which is, in his words, I forget exactly how he put it, but a pack of lies.
And just before we go into the break, Oren, what happens next? I mean, where does the real investigation take place now? What are we watching now?
Well, the investigation has multiple strands, but the one that I guess that focuses on the president is being handled by Robert Mueller, another former FBI director who's also very highly respected. And he's a special counsel.
He's been appointed special counsel
to investigate this issue. And this investigation, I think, is going to take some time.
We'll have more in just a minute, but first a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, David Rennie, The Economist. And joining me today are Linda Feldman of the Christian Science Monitor and Oren Dorel of USA Today. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. The program's also available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. So, slightly self-indulgently, I am originally from the UK. I would like to talk about the British election because my sober, sensible country that for so long had, you know, reasonably boring politics has gone basically mad for the last couple of years. And last night we had another example of this, that Theresa May, the sober, boring, very serious Conservative Prime Minister, called a snap election 3 years early when she did not have to, because the opinion polls told her that she was way, way ahead and that she could increase her majority and, in her words, get a mandate to go into Brussels particularly and negotiate the toughest, best deal for Britain on Brexit. And so she launched this election campaign, frankly, when a lot of British people didn't want to have one, because it looked like she could walk away with a landslide win. That didn't quite work out, did it, Linda? What happened?
Well, she lost seats, and she lost her majority, and has apparently cut a deal with the small Democratic Union Party of Northern Ireland, which I think won 10 seats.
That's right. They're hardline Protestants opposed to the idea of merging with Ireland.
So the implication, you know, there was a lot of, in my circles, some speculation that maybe she would step down, maybe Boris Johnson would become prime minister. I guess she's going to...
The sort of flamboyant foreign minister of the UK.
Exactly, and that she's apparently going to stick with it and try to work with what she has. I'm reading in the American press, we're reading that the center in British politics has all but disappeared and that the country is as polarized as the US.
It is, and there's another, Oren, tell me what you see when you see these returns from the UK and you see traditional left-right distinctions not really being a very good guide anymore. And you see this extraordinary result where some seats, particularly kind of working class, ex-industrial kind of rust belt areas, you actually saw a swing towards the Conservatives on a kind of nationalist, anti-Europe, anti-immigrant line. But then in the big cities or in college towns full of young people, you saw a big swing towards the Labour Party. And so it looks like more of a kind of open to the world, close to the world, sort of age, generation, education kind of division, and not a neat left-right division. That seems to be the story of last night, with the middle disappearing and everyone going to these extremes. Does that remind you of anywhere else?
So, of course, we can look here at home in the United States. But actually, I see this, when I saw the results, what it reminded me of was the recent French election. And I think it was the Dutch elections also, where the right wing didn't do as well.
Although in the Netherlands, it's true that the far right candidate Geert Wilders didn't win, but he came second.
Right, but he didn't win.
Yeah.
But what struck me about this was not only the polarization, but that it seemed like the voters were buying into some of the arguments that Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour leader, was making. Which was, he was hitting May for cuts on healthcare, police and education and social programs. He was hitting her for the Brexit, which was very divisive. He was hitting her on security, terrorism. There were three attacks in London in the past 3 months. And he was hitting her on her affinity for Trump, her courting of President Trump. And there's been, Trump has been a, I guess, a divisive figure, in a way, a uniting figure in across Europe. And a lot of people are seem to be rejecting his approach and his way of looking at things, as, at least when it comes to Europe. So kind of those are the takeaways that I took from it.
And Linda, where does this leave European governments? I mean, I think I was saying last time I was at the British Embassy for a watch party, and I was saying, you know, if you're a European government, you must look at the British and think they're like the kind of the neighbourhood kids who ring your doorbell and then run away. Because,
right.
You know, last year Britain voted to leave the European Union, which basically was a demand to other Europeans to spend enormous amounts of time and energy negotiating this painful kind of divorce with Britain. And now the negotiations due to begin in just a few days. But now, presumably, the British government may ask for a sort of time out while they work out whether they've got a government.
Right. No, this is a big problem. And I mean, I think if, you know, if you're Vladimir Putin looking at this, he's laughing because he wants a confused and divided Europe. He doesn't want a strong, united Europe, including the UK. And so I think this is, you know, as you say, there's a sort of a pause and everybody's sort of scratching their heads and figuring out, well, how do we move forward?
There's some fascinating wrinkles in this. I don't want to obsess too much about Britain. Obviously, it interests me, but it may not interest everyone else. But we saw some real wrinkles. So in most of the UK, you could argue that this was an election where people wanted to listen to kind of promises that you can have magic solutions. So the Conservatives were saying, if we leave Europe and close our borders, then magically everything will feel like it should again. The Labour Party, essentially a very, very hard left programme, probably the most hard left programme any Labour leader has offered since 1983. And yet people sort of signed up for it because there was this kind of idea there's a magic money tree that will somehow produce all this magic money for spending on hospitals and schools and police.
Yeah, wasn't
and
he
stuff.
Offering something like $20,000 a year to new students or something like that?
Yeah, it's not a great advertisement for British education that young students bought this stuff because it's economic nonsense. But in Scotland, you saw a completely different scenario that Scotland had been told by the ruling nationalists that this was the right time to have a second referendum on maybe trying to become independent. And the public rejected that and actually voted for the Scottish Conservative Party for the first time in years and years in what was basically an anti-independence vote. Why do you think a little country like Scotland might suddenly be getting really cold feet about the idea of going it alone and trying to become independent?
Well, I think that they're seeing the disruption that it causes and that it's causing in Britain. And I think it ties into this other trend that I was talking about earlier, that a lot of Europeans want to stay in Europe. They like the idea of the European Union and the stability that it provides.
Or at least
provides.
They're frightened of the alternatives. I think there's a lot of discontent.
Yeah, there's discontent and there's definitely division about this. But I think a lot of people they want the stability and they want the prosperity that goes along with it.
So, Oran, you mentioned that, unfortunately, Britain's election was preceded by some terrorist attacks at a pop concert in Manchester with Ariana Grande. Then you had a terrorist attack in London. We also had a terrible terrorist attack in the Iranian capital, Linda, Tehran, by the Islamic State, or at least claimed by the Islamic State, on the Iranian parliament. I mean, really shocking scenes. Tell us about that, and tell us about how that feeds into a broader sense of divisions in the Arab world over whether everyone is on the same page in fighting terrorism.
Right. No, it was shocking. I mean, Iran hasn't experienced terrorism in quite some time and was quite proud of the fact that they had evaded that curse. But now, alas, it is visiting them as well, to the point where the mausoleum of the late Ayatollah Khomeini was attacked. It would be as if terrorists had attacked the grave of John F. Kennedy in Arlington Cemetery.
Yeah.
I mean, this is just, these terrorists really know how to send a message. You know, it's part of the sort of larger conflagration that we're seeing in the Middle East. And I know this is our next topic, but just to go into, the stunning break in diplomatic relations by, you know, Saudi Arabia and other countries with Qatar in the region. This just shows sort of the lifting of barriers and borders and the disuniting of traditional allies.
So, Oran, that's exactly right, and let's tee this up. So, of course, I'm sure all of our listeners are aware that there is a very large divide within the Muslim world in the Middle East between Sunni Muslim believers. So big countries like the Saudi Arabians, Bahrain, a lot of those Gulf monarchies, at least the elite, are Sunni. And then you have the Shia Muslims, and Iran, of course, is the Shia superpower in that region. Does that play into this division that we're seeing? As Linda says, Qatar, a Sunni member of the Gulf Cooperation Council, being criticized for being too friendly to Iran, for being unreliable on terrorism by these giant Sunni superpowers led by the Saudis, but also the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Egypt. How does that feed in? Is there a sense that we are teetering on the brink of a kind of really nasty Sunni Muslim versus Shia Muslim kind of conflagration?
Well, Qatar is a Sunni country. It's a Sunni Muslim country. So it's a little odd to look at the GCC rift as a Sunni Shia split.
But the accusation leveled at the Emir of Qatar was that he was too pro-Iran.
That is the accusation. I see this more as a Sunni-Sunni split. And yes, Iran always figures into the conflicts that happen in the Middle East because it's such a big player and it's been rather aggressive in prosecuting its interests through proxies and terrorist organizations and militias that work do its bidding in places like Iraq and Bahrain and Syria and Lebanon and Yemen. But this issue with Qatar is interesting because the Saudis, who are basically the biggest exporters of Wahhabi Islam, which is a very fundamentalist and very conservative, literal form of teaching of Islam, they've funded mosques all over the world. And a lot of people blame them for propagating the ideology that groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS feed on. So it's a little bit ironic that Saudi Arabia now is joining a country like kind of a secular country like Egypt, or leadership like Egypt, which is at war with the Muslim Brotherhood, which the Qataris support. So
of course,
the Muslim Brotherhood, I mean, this gets complicated, but the Qataris have been supporting the Muslim Brotherhood, which is
it's the oldest political Islamic,
which is the political Islamic,
the
political Islamic movement. And there are allegations that it also supports maybe ISIS leaders and Al-Qaeda leaders. But they're also a U.S. ally in the fight against terrorism, and they've been flying bombing missions against ISIS in Iraq.
And that's right. So, Linda, obviously, we saw those pictures of President Trump in the Arab world addressing more than 50 Arab leaders convened by the Saudis, talking about unity in the Arab world against ISIS. Mm-hmm. Has President Trump handled this split among his Arab allies with a deft touch?
I am laughing. Donald Trump applauded the Saudi move and the others to break ties with Qatar. The astonishment of the national security community in this country, we, of course, as Oren mentioned, we have a base in Qatar from which we fight the war against ISIS. So this was, I think there was a lot of scrambling behind the scenes to paper this over.
There's one last reason, isn't there, that Qatar, although it's a very small country, although very rich, lots of gas, it's another reason why it really annoys its larger, more powerful neighbours like Saudi Arabia, is that it's home to Al Jazeera satellite television, very, very powerful television service across the Arab world. Why would that encourage someone like the Saudis to smack down on Qatar? What's going on there?
Well, because Al Jazeera is a very, I guess, critical news organization, which looks at the leadership of countries, and you know, including the United States, but also Saudi Arabia and the monarchies, in a critical manner, and giving voice to people and to critics and to the citizenry. The one place that it doesn't really criticize is Qatar, as far as I've seen.
Oddly enough. Well, we could talk about the ramifications of this forever. We'll have to come back another week and talk about the next wave of chaos. But I'm afraid that's all the time we have. And joining us today were Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and Oren Durrell, Foreign Affairs Reporter for USA Today. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief for The Economist. Thanks for listening.